So, Father, I am here at last upon the cross. Here where you have foreseen me. Here hanging upon this cross in time as you are stretched upon your cross for all eternity. Why do I hang here? Is it not because when I am so lifted up, I shall draw all men to me for your sake and for theirs? And what will men see as they here gaze up at me? Will they see their Messiah fulfilling their prophet's words for their salvation? It has been written, "Cursed is he who hangs upon a tree." And men have thought the one accursed to be an evil man, one who has gone against the will of God. Yet I hang here and am not evil, nor have I gone against my Father's will. I have done only good, and have worked as you have done, to bring men to your kingdom. But what I have done, men will interpret in their own ways. This we cannot disallow. Having declared ourselves for freedom, men will ask each other in the years to come, "Was this our Messiah sent from God?" How shall they know this question's answer? How indeed do I myself know whether I am the one all men await to set them free? How do I know I am your son, chosen for this soul sacrifice upon this cross? Can I know myself the Messiah by any other means than this, that I see your need of men, men's need of you, and will myself to be your mediator? Could I be self-deceived in this hard mediator's task? Could I know assuredly that I could tread this long and stony path other than by treading it? Must a man not elect himself to believe that God has elected him? Your spirit, Father, you have breathed into man, and man thereby has become a living soul, haunted by your presence and your name. How then could it be otherwise than that man should elect himself to be elect? And how could a man know his self-election to be rightly timed other than by this, that he can carry through his task to its full end? Babe in arms, though feeling forward to his trial, his little arms stretched out as I now stretch out mine, cannot yet stand upon his feet to bear the heavy load his father's fathers have by their sad sins laid on his soul. Did I say sins, Father? What do men know of sin? far misled them from this truth, that sin is only this: to miss the mark, to fail to hit life's target in its central point, the arrow loosed at life to fall away into the void of death. My Father and my God, whose spirit in and out myself holds monodialogue in me, I see your simple truth hung by priestcraft and by mammon's wiles, hung with a thousand veils, so that the greater number of men's souls cannot tell what form has truth beneath the veils. And so I am here upon this simple sign that tells your simple truth with but two wooden beams, one upright to stand for your creative, powerful spirit, one crossways lying to present your infinite, extended love. The very substance of your suffering self. But will men see this sign as we have willed them to see it? Or will they see instead only a man upon a cross? Only a man crucified, innocent or guilty, but by temporal power? A few men, Father, I have known when walking on this earth, who have delighted in your signs and symbols in the skies. Men of high mind and penetrating thought, men of insight and fine sense, these men have seen this cross for what it is, the sign of your dilemma and of mine. But not all men see as clearly as these few. The many, with their little schooling, cannot grasp the truth that others see so well. What do they know of your dilemma as you yourself eternally must see it? Without the well-trained mind that feeds upon the past of all men's thoughts, how can the many see the unavoidable task your very being has set itself? God is great, they say, in power, extension infinite. Therefore, he can do all things. Only, I do not see, Father, that in your all-powerfulness there is one thing not possible for you to do. You, the eternal infinite, all-powerful and all-knowing, are yet quite circumscribed by one great fact. One fact that sets the problem for us all. This fact I have tried to show to men wherever I could find the thinnest wedge to slip within their time-cracked selves. One thing, Almighty Father, you cannot do. You cannot annihilate your high eternal self. You cannot escape the very fact of your own being. You, my God, cannot cease to be God. Whatever else your high almighty being may do, it cannot remove itself from being. And there within you is your problem and your task. Ordinary beings that come to be like men in time can cease in time to be. They have a means to their escape. The life they live, if it becomes intolerable to their souls, they can lead out of time. Death is for them a possibility. Or so to them it seems. believing as they do in death. But you, Father, Lord of truth, cannot believe in death, seeing you are the eternal life itself. You cannot hope for the painless sleep of non-being that men believe that they may find to rest their weary hearts. Yours is the eternal ache of being. Beyond this world's escaping time, yours is the ever-vigilant eye that gazes into infinite light, unable to close itself against its own vast brilliance. What can ordinary men know of this? Your eternal being, Father, and of your eternal problem. Till through men it shall be solved. My heart has bled for you, O God. In your high and lonely self, where no man yet has been and stayed himself, before me in the time there have been many men who found you but to lose themselves. These, the great mystics of the East, like him they call Gotama of the Sakyas, the Buddha, who on finding you slipped like a dewdrop into the infinite shining sea and were lost to themselves, annihilating self, their target. But these mystics, great as they might have been within their time, did not solve your problem, neither mine. And their faithful followers who strove to tread along their path, feeling uneasily that something wrong had crept into their doctrine, rewrote the mystic word their master had delivered to their souls, and taught a doctrine new, not quite the one they had received. For now, they said, the infinite sea had given back their dewdrop for their thirst. Their vanished Buddha, they had willed reborn. How faithful, Father, is the inner heart of man wherein you placed your spirit to your logic. The mind within this heart, fed by your inner self, cannot rest satisfied with anything less than truth. So the escaped mystics were called back again by the needy souls of men to try again to solve the riddle of yourself. How I love those beings who cannot rest because they have not yet found truth. I love them, Father, as I love yourself with all its restlessness from which these beings have come to be. Of all your creatures that your ceaseless self has brought to be, I love those most who seek to give you rest from your eternal work. For these are nearest to the truth which I have voiced when I have said to men, my Father works, and I work also. Not that they or I can give you rest, for this cannot be with your eternal power. But we can fulfill the purpose you foresaw for us when first you brought us into being. I have tried, Father, with with all the might that is my own, which you have given me as a gift, to bring to you, your other creatures, to bring them to your way. I have told them what I could, according to their power to understand, of how I work, as you have worked in me. I have told them in the simplest way. In stories, like old men may tell a child, the parables I have used contain sweet hidden seeds, which once sown in their minds will bring forth fruit. These things I have learned from your eternal mind and then taught men. But then the problem brought to me by time, who eats away each moment that he brings, was how to fix within men's minds the lessons they had learned. So, gazing into your eternity to find the instrument most fittingly designed to fix the truth in men, I saw within your infinite self a cross of light. Upon which you stretched yourself forever in your eternal power. Then, Father, I knew within my earthly self the self-same cross of power I saw in you, and instantly the eternal vision came in which you had foreseen me here. Who can tell at what swift point eternity may break forth into the time? Certainly it is not given for man on earth to know it. Only the eternal itself can know this. Only you, O God, my Father, can reveal this secret thing. Yet I know that nothing that comes to be is new, that all things here on earth have come into the time from out your vast eternal being. Therefore I have said to men, before Abraham was, I am. Before the temporal Abraham was, my eternal being is within your heart. And this, my Father, is the most powerful truth of all your truths. Before Abraham was, I am. For when all men shall know this truth within the substance of their being, then shall your foreseen purpose in them be fulfilled. For you, most merciful one, great ruler of the world, have willed that all men here shall know this truth, that they are also beings of your being. They also are beings not of time alone, but of eternity. From this most excellent truth shall come the courage in men's hearts that will enable them to stand in time against the false oppressors of the world. Long ago, Father, you made man and set him in a pleasant place, a garden where all things he needed were at hand. You told this man that he could eat of every tree save one, the tree of knowledge. He eating the truth of which good and evil would be known. Poor man. He, in his innocence, ate this fruit and found himself at once deprived of innocence and its power. Suddenly he saw the world in two, made dual by the knowledge he had gained. Oh, Father, if only he had known before he ate the sorrow he would bring upon us all. You in your infinity cannot fall as did this man. You, all-knowing, could see within your own mind, which is one with your creation, all the far results of this great schism. You knew the unreality of this knife cut, good and evil in the time. You had eternally solved this problem before the world was born. As with Samson's riddle, out of the eater came forth meat, so with the riddle of this world, you, O Lord, my Father, are the eater, and we, your creatures, are the meat you eat. A thought for earthbound men most terrible to bear. For they would rather be the eater than the meat. Yet, Father, and eater of us all, if we can understand it, it is not something that can make us fear. For what are we but yourself, pressed out from your eternal being into time? If you eat us, does it not mean, as we are one, we but eat up ourselves and you? This is why I have told my disciples here on earth that they must eat my body. Yes, and drink my blood if they are to come into your being. What will they think of these words when I am no longer here in time? Certainly they cannot disbelieve them, for they know I am the truth, and the cross I hang upon will not let them forget. But how will men understand these words? They will provoke them to think and find a meaning when I am no longer here, and some will find the truth that we all eat each other, body, heart, and mind, in subtle ways the earthly eye can hardly see. Then, Father, we can invite all men to the feast to eat their fill in ways they cannot yet quite understand. Eternal sentient power, O God, is all yourself's own essence, and every being is of this power alone. It doesn't matter, Lord, which way this matter creates. This power creates. It is itself its own creation, itself its own effect. This sentient power itself, with all its infinite extension, is but your love. All love is power extended as your created world. The power that beats in every living heart and holds each crystalled orb within its frame is but your will, and sphered by itself. But your eternal self, your infinite power, is stretched forever through your endless realm in beams of light, crossed and crossed again upon itself in inescapable bondage to itself. This I have seen when gazing deep into your abyssal heart, And here have I learned the answer to the problem of yourself and man. Therefore, I hang upon this darker earthly cross below, abstracted from your cross of light above. Eternity now breaks into the time, and in men's minds and hearts. And men, who have fled through time the shadow of their misaimed lives, now see in me upon this cross the sign of their impossible flight. And who can look upon this cross, my God, and fail to see his own despairing being nailed here with mine? Man's mind has turned itself away from this dread thought since Adam turned away from your first high command: do not presume to separate the evil and the good. It seemed to Adam then, as to men now, that you, O God, would fix their way of life as on a cross. For all commands except their own appear to men as bonds upon their will. Therefore, since Adam, man has fled through time to escape the cross, not seeing in their fear its inescapable form within their very being. I have tried, Father, to show to men that you yourself are crucified in men, and they in you. But in their dulled, fear-shadowed minds, they have not dared to face the meaning of my words. Save us from the cross of our severed will, all men since Adam have cried out to you, not knowing to whom they prayed. They haven't seen the logic of your being, the inescapable, eternal self you are. They have not seen that you're all-knowing. Mind cannot disclose a way for you to escape from your all-powerful, eternal self. They have not known that your omniscient eye has seen no other help than man for your salvation. They have been so totally concerned with their own need of help from you. Oh, how little comfort there is to come from one who comfort seeks beyond itself. The wise have pondered in their minds and asked themselves, what is man that God should be so mindful of him? To those who look on man as one small being clinging to a speck of whirling dust in infinite space, man can have no significance for you, nor you for him. Therefore they cannot solve the riddle of his being or yours, nor can they understand your first command to man: do not presume to separate the evil from the good. In arguing with the wise men of this world, I have made clear the wise man's inability to see what would display his unwisdom to himself. Or, worse by far, to those who think him wise. Since Adam ate what you had forbidden him, and so became a knower of the evil, torn out from the good and set beside it for his choice, he and all men have been shrouded in the fear of error and its painful fruit. Since their first eating, all men are afraid of what they seek, the wholeness that their first bite broke into. For this same wholeness can be gained again only by eating the half they would reject. Oh, Father, is hard for man to see the logic of his choice lead unavoidably to death. How could Innes and Adam, first man within this world, know before he knew the meaning of his first response to life? How could he live his life before his life, seeing life as choice? How could he know that your command contained a hidden hint that first a man must choose whether or not to choose? How could he see the real significance of choice before his choosing? You, O God, within your all-beholding eye from all eternity have seen each choice that may be made. You have seen that first of all one must choose whether to choose or not. And then if choice be made, that it may be a choice between the whole or part, before a choice between one part and another. Could Adam, with his newly opened eyes gazing into the play of time, have seen the real choice there presented to his will? Could he have seen that all that you required of him was but to take life whole and not in part? Could he have seen before the fact that taking life in part to lose the whole is all you mean by sin? To sin, to miss the mark, is certain if one takes a part where only the whole can satisfy man's soul. You and I, O Father of myself, have seen this truth and know its meaning in our heart. But man, treading Adam's steps, rejecting wholeness in his fearful part, cannot without our aid restore his severed self to its own source. Once wholeness of mind is lost, the shadowed parts cannot of themselves regain their proper place. Only the whole can heal what is not whole. Therefore, my God, the all-whole Lord of all, apart from you, man has no hope of his release from bondage to the severed part. And this sad slavery to the part is death, the only death there is. The chaining of man's mind and heart and will to less than all there is for him to love. Strange Lord, that man once fallen down from wholeness of life, which you call holiness, should fear to lose his hold on that which spoils his life. Yet not so strange to you, whose logic does not err. For once the whole is lost, the shut-out soul can only judge the world from what he has, and that he has made part of all that is cannot but be perceived as his sole means of safety in the world. Poor man, deprived of hope of wholeness, holds the part as his salvation and will not let it go. He marks his patch of earth and hedges it round with circular defining words, all his own. And to this own, his self-defined possession, he then dedicates his life and so compacts his death. This have I told your people and have taught them that whole life cannot be gained except by giving up this slavery to the part. But amongst the part slaved sons of men, some have so enwrapped themselves in robes of fear of loss of power against their fellow men that they have devised for their defense a doctrine full of falsities which they teach to those they would enslave to curb their free response to life. The life you have poured forth into your world. I have seen these power-blinded leaders of your people in Jerusalem, your holy city, pour the lifeblood of 1,000 trembling beasts upon your temple's altar. Declaring their bloody sacrifices please your mind. Sad sacrificial rites that hold out to ignorant men a hope of heaven's salvation and really serve but to extend the power of the teachers of the rites and those who join their game. What then, Father, shall I do? I cannot curse these preachers of the useless rites, knowing their fearful self-defending cause. I cannot call upon your infinite power to naught that tottering world. These pseudo-leaders, impelled by fear, have made their minds the dwelling place of ignorance, their hearts a cavern of non-compassion for their fellow men, their hands the instruments of inevitable self-destruction. While they seek to build the house they call your own. No, Father, I cannot call down your wrath upon these ignorant men. I pray, rather, for their souls, and ask you to forgive the evil deeds which their darkened minds bring forth, like fungoid growths from light-starved dungeons underground. Upon the temple walls, within your sacred city, are fastened heavy plates of purest gold to catch the rising sun's gold rays and throw their brilliance back, to dazzle the startled eyes of pilgrims who have trodden a painful stony road to fill their eyes with the vision of your holy house. Blinded by the golden temple's mirrored rays, the pilgrims cannot see your simple truth, which needs no goldsmith's art to make it shine. They cannot see the secret source of all the love they feel for your temple, hidden within their own truth-seeking hearts. Their dazzled eyes, they turn still outwards towards the temple's golden blazing walls. They do not understand. Their love, which they feel welling up within their souls, is not inspired by the temple, but by your eternal self. They do not see, O Lord of love, that all they seek is the occasion to pour forth their hearts and minds into a larger world where love speaks with a deeper word back to the lover. They do not hear the logic of your word saying in their hearts, seek love at its source where God has placed it within man's central self. They see only the blinding golden glare of the outer temple's walls, and in their awe-struck minds they cry, this is what our pilgrimage is for. This is our journey's end. We have seen the temple of our God. And now may we return to our own walled cities and there rest content. But, great God, creator of us all, you have not made man poor, nor do you desire to keep him so. You have not given man perceiving eyes to close in sleep before he's seen your love's creation. You have not placed within him your divine compulsion to bring forth infinite wonderful things so that he may sink down to nothingness. No. You have placed your spirit in the man of dust to breathe him into life. Your life, which knows no end. Your life, which lives in every living thing and shows itself within a myriad forms of joy. And in this widest opportunity to live, I hang here in narrow prelude to my death, to bring the minds of men to your one point, the point of love. Love, as yourself and mine have known it. I call myself the Son of Man as well as Son of God, my Father of the Spirit. I call myself to man the Son of Man, so that he may see that man may live from in himself, summing the world of every man to his own significance. Once long ago, Father, you were father too to Abraham, and counted his faith in you as righteousness. Then further, you fathered Isaac, and then again the gentle Jacob. And the years sped by, and then you sired David, who bravely stood against Goliath's mighty threat. Now I, in looking back through time, see a thousand men pass on into their future, which is mine. I see these men of spirit striving through the generations of your people to do your will. I feel within myself their million wills intent. And sum it up within myself, knowing I would not be here if they had not willed my day. Therefore I call myself the Son of Man, the recipient of all men's wills that have striven for truth. I hang upon this cross, and Abraham rejoiced to know this day would come, and with this cross summate all men's goodwill and fix it in their minds and hearts forever, so that they will not forget. You, O great Creator, in your infinitely extended power before you had created, dwelt alone, and said, as later as you said to Adam, to be alone is not good. Your eternal power, boundless in its motion, could not reveal its hidden infinite forms unless it took upon itself self-limitation. Therefore you took upon yourself the bound and limit of yourself's own will to be, and made the greater world, of which this world is but a shadowed part. There in your infinite heart, you hanged yourself upon your macrocosmic cross, and so designed the archetype for all creation, and for me. You, our Father, who know you willed your cross, the stern necessity of being, have no great problem of the role of pain. You know, from in your light's eternal logic, that if one will not die, one must abide alone. So also I know this after my Gethsemane. But other men, whose fathers had not found the way of life and so could not pass on its secret to our day, know not this truth. And it is to these men who have not known this eternal law of being that I have spoken and now speak in my hanging here. Here on this cross I have made a picture worth the whole world's words. A sign and symbol which in one swift glance contains the whole world's joy and pain. How shall man receive a searing wound with this glance, so deeply in their souls that they will not be healed till they have learned the lesson that I teach? No man may look upon this body of the Son of Man upon this cross without somewhere in his soul an echo sound of his own pinning here. I, who am one man and all, shall show my brother man upon this cross the truth of their own crucifixion. Since Adam fell, few men have dared to gaze upon the fact of their ill deeds long effect. Few men have dared to see that every evil act bears evil fruit and must do so. And no man at all, has willed to pay the price of all men's sins. Only I, myself, have seen the necessity of someone's son hanging upon a cross to turn the averted eyes of man to see the truth. But how do I know that I should be this one? How do I know that I am right to tread the painful Savior's course? If Adam could not know before his disobedient deed the nature of his fall, can I presume to know the fruit of my obedience? And only if I bear the fruit you will, am I proved right in bearing this great wrong. To bear this fruit, I must not only die, but also resurrect. I must not only lay down my life, but also take it up again. So far, all men have believed only in death, as certain, not in life. But all who have gone down into the tomb have stayed there to corrupt. And the silent, busy worms have demonstrated death as final and beyond reverse. Kneeling before this hard finality of death, men have been brought to less than men and have been made the slaves of fear. So that their lives have come to be no more than living death. And those of sharpened minds who saw this fear and willed to save themselves by gaining power over other men have willed to use the threat of death to bind their brothers to their cause. Empires, the mighty ones, are built upon the stones of fear, trodden by vast, violent armies, tricked out with the sable plumes and reddened swords of war. Death has been made the servant of the powerful few and has been used a specter to affright the many from their right to life. At the will of kings, the skeleton arms have swung the scythe and cast its shadow on the souls of submen. And these poor creatures, Father, rendered less than men, have sent their prayers swift flying through the world for help. Some reaching up to your throne to save their souls from death. And you, the Father of them all, have made to them your only possible response. You have said that you will come down to their aid to show them how to die and live through death. But yet, O Eternal One, You, even you, cannot of your infinite self reveal your everlasting life without the help of some fit son of man. For your infinity cannot of itself be made a finite form for men to see. Therefore you have need of someone here on this dark earth to make your demonstration plain. You must make entrance in the body of a man to make men see. And so, Father, seeing your need of one to serve your will and manifest your living power over death, I have worked to make myself elect to take your part. Yet this man's body that I have has not yet known the taste of death. And so I cannot know how death shall take it, or what change may come into my soul when death's dread shadow shall blot out my mind. And as this body has not yet known death, so has it not known resurrection. The rabbis have said of man, he who dies leaving no children, when he's dead, he's really dead. His life having gone down into the grave shall never rise again. And therefore have men in fear of eternal death taken wives to bear their children and their name, seeing in these their life's continuance beyond the tomb. But seeing their lives escaping death only within their children, they have not escaped the fear of death. Rather, their fear, like their children, they have projected forth into their future, and so strangled the still unborn, whose lives they thought their own. Therefore, another solution must be found. The soul of man cannot forever lie trembling under the fearful shadow of dark death. So I am here to find the way you know, the eternal way you found, and the only place you could find it, in your eternal heart. And I have come so far as this. I hang and am prepared for death within this body, whose very flesh now shrinks before the fact that I am here. And I also, just as you, must find it in myself to face this hard last enemy, as so must every man at last, for none can die another's death. Yet one may die to show a man how a death should be. How a death should be. Up to the point of death. But what beyond? How shall the dead, if truly dead, raise up itself again? If I have brought myself this far, and here I am, my father, it is not without your spirit's help. But death, to be true death, requires your spirit to withdraw. If you, my father, do not take away your spirit from this form, how can this death be real? Your infinite self is life eternal beyond all possibility of death. Therefore, if I am to die, you must forsake me and leave me to myself. But in your infinity, your all-pervading self is everywhere. And so the logic of my human mind declares you cannot leave my soul. Oh, my Lord. The mind of man cannot descend into the mystery of yourself's own spirit. But this is clear.
I am in truth to die and not just fall into unknowingness. Merely as if I die. You must withdraw your spirit from this self. If you do not, when I am raised again, if so I am, and men begin to doubt my death, they may truly say he didn't die, he fainted on the cross of pain and went into a state like death, which was not so. Then would my death be no true real death, but as a juggler's trick, and all my pain a senseless mockery. No. O great eternal spirit, I must ask you, pray you, to forsake this body, so that I may truly die as I must truly raise myself. For I have said, I will lay my life down and take it up again. Then if I truly die, when I am taken down and laid within the tomb as other men, I shall have done as other men. Which I must do if I am to say to them when I am raised, follow in my way and face your cross as I have mine. When I am raised, should I not rather say, if I am raised, for if there is here no uncertainty that I shall rise, I shall have missed what other men must face. The awful doubt in life's own power to resurrect itself. But if I allow this doubt, do I not weaken my resolve and so reduce the certainty that I shall rise? Shall I not reduce my certainty to a mere possibility which may corrupt itself within the grave and so give death the victory? Ah, God, who hast solved this problem within yourself? This body is so tired upon this cross. I feel a shadow cross my mind. The shadow of the death I sought. My mind grows faint. Faintly beats my heart, if it does beat. My blood hesitates within my veins and cannot now find strength to course its way. Oh! A moment, and another moment left before I fall into the darkening night, which now I feel descend into the unknown, deep, abyssal void, where all the dead before me have already gone. Gone. Have they all gone into the cold? The oh so cold, cold tomb. And I am cold. And darkness creeps over the darkening earth, The light is going out. And I must go. Father, into your hands I give this self. Which is yours. Father, the self which I lay down, I have not before, nor has any man done this thing that I have now to do. If I should fail to raise myself again, Father, I ask you, in your eternal mind, to remember me and place upon another cross. Another man who shall more truly do, if it be possible, your will. But I have come so far, Father. Perhaps, oh, pray for me. Perhaps I shall not fail to show to men your way.
You, our Father, who know you willed your cross, the stern necessity of being, have no great problem of the role of pain. You know, from in your light's eternal logic, that if one will not die, one must abide alone. So also I know this after my Gethsemane. But other men, whose fathers had not found the way of life and so could not pass on its secret to our day, know not this truth. And it is to these men who have not known this eternal law of being that I have spoken and now speak in my hanging here. Here on this cross I have made a picture worth the whole world's words. A sign and symbol which in one swift glance contains the whole world's joy and pain.
How shall man receive a searing wound with this glance, so deeply in their souls that they will not be healed till they have learned the lesson that I teach? No man may look upon this body of the Son of Man upon this cross without somewhere in his soul an echo sound of his own pinning here. I, who am one man and all, shall show my brother man upon this cross the truth of their own crucifixion. Since Adam fell, few men have dared to gaze upon the fact of their ill deeds long effect. Few men have dared to see that every evil act bears evil fruit and must do so. And no one, no man at all,
has willed to pay the price of all men's sins. Only I, myself, have seen the necessity of someone's son hanging upon a cross to turn the averted eyes of man to see the truth. But how do I know that I should be this one? How do I know that I am right to tread the painful Savior's course? If Adam could not know before his disobedient deed the nature of his fall, can I presume to know the fruit of my obedience? And only if I bear the fruit you will, am I proved right in bearing this great wrong. To bear this fruit, I must not only die, but also resurrect. I must not only lay down my life, but also take it up again. So far, all men have believed only in death as certain, not in life. But all who have gone down into the tomb have stayed there to corrupt. And the silent, busy worms have demonstrated death as final and beyond reverse. Kneeling before this hard finality of death, men have been brought to less than men and have been made the slaves of fear. So that their lives have come to be no more than living death. And those of sharpened minds who saw this fear and willed to save themselves by gaining power over other men have willed to use the threat of death to bind their brothers to their cause. Empires the mighty ones have built upon the stones of fear, trodden by vast, violent armies, tricked out with the sable plumes and reddened swords of war. Death has been made the servant of the powerful few and has been used a specter to affright the many from their right to life. At the will of kings, the skeleton arms have swung the scythe and cast its shadow on the souls of submen. And these poor creatures, Father, rendered less than men, have sent their prayers swift flying through the world for help, some reaching up to your throne to save their souls from death. And you, the Father of them all, have made to them your only possible response. You have said that you will come down to their aid to show them how to die and live through death. But yet, O Eternal One, you, even you, cannot of your infinite self reveal your everlasting life without the help of some fit son of man. For your infinity cannot of itself be made a finite form for men to see. Therefore you have need of someone here on this dark earth to make your demonstration plain. You must make entrance in the body of a man to make men see. And so, Father, seeing your need of one to serve your will and manifest your living power over death, I have worked to make myself elect to take your part. Yet this man's body that I have has not yet known the taste of death. And so I cannot know how death shall take it, or what change may come into my soul when death's dread shadow shall blot out my mind. And as this body has not yet known death, so has it not known resurrection. The rabbis have said of man, he who dies leaving no children, when he's dead, he's really dead. His life having gone down into the grave shall never rise again. And therefore have men, in fear of eternal death, taken wives
to bear their children and their name, seeing in these their life's continuance beyond the tomb. But seeing their lives escaping death only within their children, they have not escaped the fear of death. Rather, their fear, like their children, they have projected forth into their future, and so strangled the still unborn, whose lives they thought their own. Therefore, another solution must be found. The soul of man cannot forever lie trembling under the fearful shadow of dark death. So I am here to find the way you know, the eternal way you found, and the only place you could find it, in your eternal heart. And I have come so far as this. I hang and am prepared for death within this body, whose very flesh now shrinks before the fact that I am here. And I also, just as you, must find it in myself to face this hard last enemy, as so must every man at last, for none can die another's death. Yet one may die to show a man how a death should be. How a death should be. Up to the point of death. But what beyond? How shall the dead, if truly dead, raise up itself again? If I have brought myself this far, and here I am, my father, it is not without your spirit's help. But death, to be true death, requires your spirit to withdraw. If you, my father, do not take away your spirit from this form, how can this death be real? Your infinite self is life eternal beyond all possibility of death. Therefore, if I am to die, you must forsake me and leave me to myself. But in your infinity, your all-pervading self is everywhere. And so the logic of my human mind declares you cannot leave my soul. Oh, my Lord. The mind of man cannot descend into the mystery of yourself's own spirit. But this is clear. If I am in truth to die and not just fall into unknowingness, merely as if I die, you must withdraw your spirit from this self. If you do not, when I am raised again, if so I am, and men begin to doubt my death, they may truly say he didn't die, he fainted on the cross of pain and went into a state like death, which was not so. Then would my death be no true real death, but as a juggler's trick, and all my pain a senseless mockery. No. O great eternal spirit, I must ask you, pray you, to forsake this body so that I may truly die as I must truly raise myself. For I have said, I will lay my life down and take it up again. then if I truly die, when I am taken down and laid within the tomb as other men, I shall have done as other men. Which I must do if I am to say to them when I am raised, follow in my way and face your cross as I have mine. When I am raised,
should I not rather say, if I am raised? For if there is here no uncertainty that I shall rise, I shall have missed what other men must face, the awful doubt in life's own power to resurrect itself. But if I allow this doubt, do I not weaken my resolve, and so reduce the certainty that I shall rise? Shall I not reduce my certainty to a mere possibility which may corrupt itself within the grave and so give death the victory? Oh, God! Who hast solved this problem within yourself? This body is so tired upon this cross. I feel a shadow cross my mind. Is this the shadow of the death I sought? My mind grows faint. Faintly beats my heart, if it does beat. My blood hesitates within my veins and cannot now find strength to course its way. Oh, a moment, and another moment left before I fall into the darkening night, which now I feel descend into the unknown, deep, abyssal void, where all the dead before me have already gone. Gone. Have they all gone? Into the cold. The oh so cold tomb. And I am cold. And darkness creeps over the darkening earth. The light is going out. And I must go. Father, into your hands I give this self. Which is yours. Father, the self which I lay down, I have not before, nor has any man done this thing that I have now to do. If I should fail to raise myself again, Father, I ask you in your eternal mind to remember me and place
another man, who shall more truly do? If it be possible, your will. But I have come so far, Father. Perhaps. Oh, pray for me. Perhaps I shall not fail. Who shall to men? Your way.